Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 8th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Context, Outline, Introduction, Chapter 1, Session 1 of Revelation, A Message of Hope, presented by David Amidon. Let's listen in.
My name is Dave Amidon. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, pastor of St. Philip Lutheran Church and half of a clergy couple. I'm here as part of a sabbatical program that just on the front end of. This is the eighth, so this is day eight of my 3 month sabbatical time. So I'm still kind of settling in and enjoying the front end of this time. Ah, good. Well, morning. We talked last night, so they don't blow you in. In fact, we went to the same college in central Pennsylvania. And idiots. I still have this t-shirt on. Juniata College.
Amazing.
It is. It's a college of about 1,000, 1,200 students now. Two people in the same place in the middle of the Cascade Mountains. Who would guess? We didn't graduate the same year. So thank you for coming and being part of this. Yeah, everybody ready for the first day of school?
That's it.
I'm not sure how I'm going to follow that, though. Let's begin with a prayer. Lord God, it's good to be here. It's good to celebrate, good to laugh, and to gather as your people. You reveal yourself to us in so many ways. It's just a joy to be your people and to share the community that you've created in this place and around the world, across time and across space. Bless this time. May it be rich and fruitful as we learn more about what it means to be your people in this time, in this place, and looking ahead for all of eternity. In the name of our Lord and our Savior, Jesus Christ. We're diving into a different world when we open the last book of the Bible, Revelation. I always like to begin classes by asking you, by kind of figuring out where we are. Has anyone here read Revelation? Just sat down and read it, so it's familiar territory. Okay, three. Has anybody here never looked at it? That's a fair question. I have no idea what's in there. Okay. Let me just get a feel. What do you remember about Revelation? Now you've had some exposure to it. You've heard some stuff about it. Where are we? If you know more than I do, there's no sense doing these five sessions. That'll save a bunch of time, and we'll go fishing.
I hope you can explain a little better than I understood it when I read it.
Okay. All right, so we're looking for some explanation. Maybe get a grasp of what's there, yeah. Throw out some words that you associate with Revelation.
Controversy.
Controversy, yeah.
Symbols,
right.
Allegory.
Say again?
Allegory.
Allegory, maybe.
Disturbing.
We'll talk about that. Disturbing.
Ugliness.
Yeah. Some people even would go as far as frightening. I've had some people say they're afraid to read Revelation. What's in there? Right. Yeah. What I hope to accomplish in these five short sessions, granted we're not going to be able to do a comprehensive study of Revelation by any means, but I hope that we can get a better grasp of what's in the text, that we'll have some understanding of the richness and the depth and the overwhelming sort of message that's in Revelation. I hope that you'll leave here with some sort of sense that you know where it begins and where it ends and how it gets there. The beginning is right there. We're going to talk about that in a second. The ending is a powerful, powerful message of hope and optimism and trust in God, who is not only the creator, but the redeemer of everything that exists. It ends with an eternal and perpetual light, and Jesus Christ being that light, so nothing else is necessary. That's where it ends up. Between here and there, there's a bunch of stuff. And we're going to wade through that during these sessions and see what they can communicate, all those things in there. The outline that I've tentatively laid out is today we'll hopefully just deal with the very first verses, trying to get to the end of chapter 1. I don't know if we'll make it or not. Tomorrow we're going to take a look at chapters 2 through 11 that deal with the seven letters, the seven seals, the seven trumpets. On day 3, we'll deal with the conflict and the plagues, you know, all the fun stuff in chapters 12 to 16. Day 4, and that'll be Thursday evening, right? That's a break. My sessions are 9 o'clock every day except Thursday, which will be an evening session. We'll talk about defeat and victory. That's where this famous Battle of Armageddon is supposed to be. But if anybody finds it, let me know. And then day 5, we'll talk about this wonderful message of hope that just floods everything that we're about. If anybody's interested, there are a number of excellent books on Revelation. There are a number of books that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole on Revelation. This one I found right before I came, and it offers some commentary on the text, but it's mostly commentary that helps interpret the woodcuts by Albrecht Dürer. He did a series of woodcuts dealing with Revelation. Are you familiar with Dürer's work? He's a German artist, and he's best known for woodcuts of all kinds of things, but he did a pile of them on biblical texts, and he did, I've forgotten, 12, 13, 14 on Revelation. So I thought this is a really neat book. The commentary is very accessible and very helpful and very geared to our time in the beginning of the 21st century. It's copyrighted just a year or two ago. But these woodcuts date from just after the time of the Reformation, I think, was Dürer, 1600-something. He lived in Germany and the part of France that used to be Germany, in Alsace. He lived for a while in Strasbourg. Very, very detailed, very dynamic, lots of action. They're wonderful. There are a few copies of this in the bookstore, so if you hurry, you can get one. If you'd like to do
What's the title?
It's called simply Apocalypse.
Okay.
Subtitle, A Commentary on Revelation in Words and Images. It's by St. John Press, I think. Oh, Liturgical Press, yeah. But I found it fascinating. All right, before we get here, we need to take a look at what we're dealing with Revelation. This is not literature like we read every day now. This is a different kind of literature. It's called apocalyptic literature, therefore the title Apocalypse. In some translations, it's called the Apocalypse. Some translations, it's called Revelation. Anybody know how apocalypse breaks down as a word? That's familiar. Actually, Revelation does the same thing. From the Latin, revelatio. Apo means, in the Greek, from. like in remove in English, you know, to take off of, to un something. Mm-hmm. And velatio, yeah, that'll translate as veil. So what we're dealing with apocalypse or with revelation is to take the cover off of something, to take the cover from something, to reveal, to unveil something. So what we're after when we deal with apocalypse and revelation is the unveiling of something. It's like when you, there's a big curtain here, and you part the curtain and you see what's going on behind it. That's what we're coming at this text from. It's a glimpse. It's just a quick look at what's behind the curtain with this unveiling, and there's no explanation. When you part the curtain, you just see it and you say, "Wow!" And then the curtain closes. All right. So there's not time to explain all this stuff. There's not time to nicely lay out all the possible meanings and interpretations in the text. In the apocalypse, it's just letting you get a glimpse. It's just exposing what's there. It's unveiling. Okay? So that's the kind of approach that we have, even from the title that was added later, of course, that in the biblical text. It's important to remember the context always when you do biblical study, but Revelation in particular. This was probably written in the second half of the first century. Right? So who was in charge of Israel and what we now know as, you know, Palestine area at that point? It was part of the Roman Empire, right? So the power was way off in Rome. Roman soldiers present, Roman administration in place, and yet the Christian community was there and active, but also very much in danger. Sometimes Revelation's interpreted as being in the middle of a huge persecution of Christians. That's being questioned now. Some of the re-examination of the historical documents that they have, and they're very limited, granted, from that time, really don't add up to a major persecution and lots of Christians being killed. Yet, at any given moment, Christians who are not ready to swear allegiance to Caesar, to Rome, were in danger and were executed. So we know that was going on. Even if there weren't thousands of martyrs being created at that moment. So it was a very difficult time for the Christian community. They had to live underground, not live underground, but they worshipped underground, though sometimes in catacombs and in places where they wouldn't be caught. Because if they're worshipping God in Jesus Christ, the Romans, who probably under the Emperor Domitian, who wanted very badly to be known as Caesar and God, you know, God and Lord of the Roman Empire, demanded that kind of loyalty. Christians weren't about to do that. And so they were seen as unpatriotic, unfaithful to the government, and all kinds of nasty things. And some of those things were punishable by death. So Christians were put to death for their faith. So when they worshipped, when they gathered, they had to be careful not to be caught. So it was that sort of atmosphere that we're dealing with in the Christian community. Right? Another thing to keep in mind as we enter into this apocalyptic literature is the idea of symbolism that somebody mentioned. Very, very powerful symbols. When you see a political cartoon and you see a donkey and an elephant fighting, all right, paint that picture in your mind. What's going on?
Argument.
argument. But who are the donkey and the elephant?
Republicans, Democrats.
Republicans,
political
Democrats.
Opponents.
Political opponents. Everybody knows that, right? So when you see those images, everybody knows the message. You don't have to write Republican. You don't have to write Democrat. Everybody knows the symbols. Yeah. You see this guy with the striped pants and the hat and the stars and stripes on the hat. Who is that?
Patriotic.
Uncle Sam. Right. Everybody knows the symbol. Right. You don't have to explain this is a symbol of the United States, but this guy standing there, everybody knows it. Well, we can make the same assumption about the symbols in Revelation. For those who are insiders, those who know the code, all these symbols make sense. All the many-headed beasts and the eagle and whatever else is in there. Oh yeah, of course. That's Rome. That's the emperor. Those are the good guys. Those are the bad guys. Right? If you like the donkey, then the elephant's the bad guy. If you like the elephant, then the donkey's the bad guy. Right? You know the story. So we can assume that that's the case. And we'll look at some of those as we wander through the text. I want to do some of the number symbolism, though, with you. This is really important because there are numbers all the way through Revelation. Some of the symbolic numbers. What would be the number 3? We can figure some of these things out because they make sense.
Trinity.
Trinity. It's a divine number, right? Number dealing with God, with holy things, things of heaven. Yeah, often come in threes, right? For us Christians, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, of course, and things centering around that. How about the number 4? What do you think of?
You think of like gospel?
Say again.
Like gospel?
The 4 gospels, okay.
But that raises a question in my mind, though, because both of those are concepts that were developed, or at least sort of confirmed later than the writing of the book. Even the Trinity really wasn't highly developed at that time, was it?
But the idea that 3 being associated with things divine. Yeah.
Coming out of the Jewish tradition, right?
Surely they have roots in the Jewish traditions, yeah. But also the whole culture of the time, I think, if I'm not mistaken in that. The number 4, yeah, the 4 Gospels, the communication to us, the story of Jesus on earth, right? 4 is dealing with the things of the earth.
Earth, wind. Fire, is it?
Fire, earth, wind, fire, and water, aren't those the 4 elements?
Right, the elements.
Yeah, the 4 seasons, the 4 corners of the earth we talk about, the 4 directions, north, south, east, west. 4 being associated with things earthly. All right, so when you add 4 and 3, you get 7. 7, the divine number, right, the complete number. You add the things divine and things earthly, you get the whole package. Right? It's a symbol of completeness, the perfect number it's sometimes called, because it's everything all together. We'll see lots and lots of 7s as we wander through Revelation. We get 3 times 4 is 12. How many apostles? Well, how many months in a year? 12, right?
How many tribes?
Say again?
How many tribes?
Yeah, 12 tribes of Israel, right.
Hours?
Hours, right? 12 times 2, you get a full day. Yeah. So, you get the idea that 4 times 3 gives you another sense of the whole, the complete entity. Another number that will come across sometimes is 10, which is more secular, but it also communicates the whole set. How many fingers do you have? Toes, you know, we get 10 of each. 10 always comes out to nice round numbers. So it's a symbol of completeness in the secular, earthly sort of sense. It also becomes a multiplier. Right? So if you want to emphasize something and make it, raise it to the next level, you get numbers like 70.
40.
Yeah, 40, right? Yeah, 40 being a lot of something, 40 years, right? Rained 40 days and 40 nights, it rained a lot. 40 years in the desert, two generations, basically. It was a long time out in the desert. Yeah, symbolic number, surely. Let's do some more multiplying. When you get 12 times 12 is 144. And then if you really want to push that, multiply it by 10, and you get 144,000. Everybody. 144,000 is going to show up as we look through Revelation. Okay, so you get a sense of how these numbers come into play symbolically. That's important to know, keep in mind. And I have to keep track of time because I told us we're way on time. So I'll be glancing over here some. Besides, I keep myself on track. Apocalyptic literature is not rational. You can't read Revelation and kind of follow the logic of it like you can lots of texts. It's not a letter in the sense that there's a person writing to a particular community making particular points. It's in the form of a letter, sort of, but it's not a kind of letter like an epistle when you read Paul's stuff. It's not a history. It's not a narrative, like the sense of telling a story. It doesn't fit any of those categories. But apocalyptic literature deals with symbols. Symbols communicate not on an intellectual level nearly as much as on an emotional and a heart level. Right? It touches things inside us that make us go, whoa. And we're not sure why, but it connects with something inside us that's deeper in our being than words can be. Right? So that's the kind of literature we're dealing with. We'll see the words communicate in great detail, and yet the book, the images, the flow of action paints broad brush strokes. Right? So we're not looking at it fine details, although the Durer woodcuts, you have to do that because he tries to pack so much into a small space. Revelation does that too with the text, but you have to keep in mind that it's a sweeping sort of action that's going on here that keeps driving us forward and driving us to the next thing. We'll see that particularly in the seals and the trumpets when we get to that middle section. And it's driving us toward the end, toward the light, toward the message of hope, toward the resolution to some of this, where Christ is all in all. And King of kings and Lord of lords, you know, all that kind of language comes out of here. What struck me this morning, I never had a first day of school like that. That did strike me. There was nobody cheering me on when I got on the bus when I was a kid. And I thought, oh, that's too bad, you know?
Yeah.
What would the world be like if we knew about celebration like this community knows about celebration? It's in here. We'll have pictures painted for us of thousands and thousands of voices around the throne of God singing praise to God. And that's what I thought about here, you know, as the kids get off the bus and they ritually make their way toured the school with the community around them, with music and laughter and costumes and bright colors and symbols out here. Did you see the symbols out here? Yeah, the trees and the school marm and the medic and all those symbolic characters being part of the community here. That's in here too. It's marvelous. So we continue to live that sense of celebration, that sense of ritual, that sense of, I mean, there was a liturgical event happening out there with the pastor leading the way, right? And the entry into the new world for the students. Yeah, that's revelation at work. That's apocalyptic stuff. You can't describe that. You could write it down, and you could tell the story to somebody. I'll do that when I go home. I'll tell them about this first day of school, but they're not going to have any idea what it's about. That's apocalyptic sort of thing. Yeah, it goes beyond words, goes beyond description. It touches emotions. It touches history and ritual and liturgy and all kinds of things just coming together into focus. So we get a glimpse of the heavenly, of the divine. But that's what we're dealing with. Sound like fun? Yeah, let's go. I probably need to say, too, the way I like best to teach is to answer questions. All right, so I'm going to get us started. I'll prepare some stuff, and obviously I have. But please don't hesitate to ask questions. If I don't know, I'll tell you so, because you know, I'm a long way from an expert on this stuff, but I'm just so intrigued by it. I've spent a lot of time, you know, delving into Revelation. I audited the course on Revelation in seminary. You know, I didn't have time in my schedule, but I wanted to learn what it was about. And I wish I'd thrown that other stuff aside and done the work on that course. But since then, I keep being drawn back to it because it's so rich and has such a message for us in today's world. It's very apocalyptic in lots of ways. So I don't make any claim to be an expert in Greek or Hebrew tradition or even in Revelation, because I've not had the time to keep delving into it. But I know enough that I think we'll gain something out of this. And I probably will have some answers to some of your questions. So please ask them if you are moved to do so. If not, we'll keep on going until something does come up. Uh-oh.
No.
Starting already.
The catacombs that you mentioned in Rome.
Yeah.
You know, were they placed? Was that? I was there, but I don't remember. Was that where the Christians met, or were they just buried there?
They met for worship in the catacombs.
Okay.
I don't know if the one, mm-hmm. ones that you were in particularly
right.
or not,
right.
but I do know that was a safe place for them because they wouldn't be discovered. It was also a symbolic place for them because, you know, being connected to those who have gone before is a very powerful part of Christianity. So to work, you know, we do sunrise services in cemeteries today, and if you've ever been part of that. To do an Easter sunrise service, standing in the middle of the tombstones and proclaiming the resurrection is a powerful experience. So there's some of that connection in the catacombs as well.
Could you comment on the singular instead of plural, the revelation of Jesus Christ, not revelations?
Thank you. Yes, that will get us into this. If you haven't figured it out, this is the first two verses of the text. If a Bible is helpful to follow along with this, it probably will be as time goes on, and we'll do some reading together. If you don't know, there are lots of Bibles on the rack over there, if you didn't happen to bring one. If you have a favorite translation, that's great, because it's sometimes beneficial to compare translations. I'm going to work from the New Revised Standard Version, which is a translation I appreciate very much. But we also have to keep in mind, as we study any part of the Bible, that what we're dealing with is a translation of another language. Anybody speak a second language? you know the difficulty of translation, right? I speak French fairly well. Went clear through a master's degree, hoping to be a teacher, and you see where I ended up. And lived in France for 3 years. So I have a fairly good handle on the language. But it's a, translation is no small task. And there are some things that are wonderfully expressed in French, and we just don't have a word in English for it. An example is the word in French, préciser, means to precise something. If you have kind of a general argument and you want to argue it down in to a very precise point, we don't have a nice word for that. So I keep wanting to precise things in English, and you just can't do it. Same coming from the Greek into the English. So we'll take a look at some of that to give you an idea of what we're missing in the translation. But that's not to lower the impact of what we do have in the English text. All right. I thought it'd be valuable to take some time with these first couple of verses and just get a taste of the richness of the text. We're not going to be able to do this all the way through, but at least you'll get an idea. Okay, the revelation, it is singular. There's one revelation. You know, sometimes you hear about the book of Revelations. Not so. This is the revelation. In fact, what we're going to deal with is the first two verses. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testified to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. And you should have something similar to that in the first two verses. So what we have is the revelation, right? The unveiling. These two verses give us lots of clues to what's to follow, but it also sets the scene very nicely. What we're dealing with is that glimpse. That glimpse behind the curtain, or under the veil. You get to pick up a corner and look and see what's under there. There's only one. The revelation, the apocalypse, the unveiling of Jesus Christ. Now, what's interesting here in the Greek is it's in the genitive case. That's... Again, I can't explain all the details of the Greek, but I do know that the genitive case can either be the subject or the object in a sentence. All right, so if it's the revelation of Jesus Christ and he's the subject, he's the one making the revelation, right? If Jesus Christ is the object, then he's the one being revealed. You see the difference? And in the Greek, you don't know, so both are implied. So Jesus is both the subject and the object of this revelation. That happens in English with the preposition of, right? Can be the revelation of Jesus Christ. He's the one making the revelation, or he's the one being revealed. That works pretty well.
Who's writing the preface here?
Well, it's John who has the command to write down what he's
saying. Right, but he's not using the I. It's like somebody's getting ready to talk about it.
Yeah, that's right.
So it seems strange that John would write this as in that, using his own name.
Right. Yeah. So that makes a little distance between the author and what's happening.
Right. So, you know, you wonder when that part was written.
Yeah. Surely after it was all over, this prologue was added.
Right, so it could have been.
But isn't that how your English teacher told you to write a paper?
but I don't say use my own name when I'm talking about myself, though.
True. You know, normally in apocalyptic literature, it's anonymous. The apocalyptic style of writing tries to be impersonal and tries to be more universal
What are some other examples of apocalyptic literature?
Daniel, Ezekiel. Yeah, in fact, I wanted to do that. Oops, I need my glasses on the watch. Mm-hmm. Apocalyptic literature isn't used much today, but in the first century it was. The first century before the birth of Christ, and fading out, though, in the first century after the birth of Christ, apocalyptic literature was very much what was used. Daniel, particularly, is dated during the time of Nebuchadnezzar and all that stuff. Well, but it was written not long before the birth of Christ. Looking back, retrospective gives the writer a chance to be very detailed about the historical things that took place. He must really know what he's talking about. But in fact, the message is one of persecution and suffering under the hand of the conquering Greeks and Romans. The things they refer to couldn't have been from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but from much later time. But that's what apocalyptic does. It takes us out of time and gives a more universal scope. It also deals with things that are beyond what we can really describe and really know. And if you've read Ezekiel or Daniel, you know about those images in those books. But Paul, too, I'm glad you asked that question. 1 Thessalonians. In fact, you might want to look at this. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. That's one of those little books, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and then you get into the ones I can't remember very well. Thessalonians follows soon after that. It's only 4 or 5 chapters long, so it's pretty easy to miss. Right, 1 Thessalonians, in chapter 4, it's toward the end of the book. Most of this deals with fairly mundane things, fairly everyday instructions, like Paul tends to do. He's writing to the community with some advice, responding to some questions, telling them how to live a Christian life and how to get along. But then in verse 4, my section here picks up in verse 13. It talks about the coming of the Lord. It says, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do, who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have died." All right, that's fairly straightforward. We don't quite understand how that's going to work, but you know, Jesus is going to bring us along, even through the portal of death. But then the style shifts. He says, "For this we declare to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will by no means precede those who have died. For the Lord himself, with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of God's trumpet, will descend from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up in the clouds together with them to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever." Man, that's hard for me to imagine. That's not mundane sort of things. But what Paul's doing here is using style of literature from the day to try to describe things beyond what we can grasp. Right? This is not literal stuff. We're not talking about clouds and trumpets. Here we're talking about power and majesty and the glory of God and the power of God over life and death and going beyond things that we can even imagine. What does the voice of God sound like? You know, what do the trumpets sound like? Who knows? Well, what Paul's doing is lifting us to a different plane with this kind of language and opening up possibilities beyond our own experience, beyond what we can know for ourselves. And then the next verse is what it's about. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. We in the 21st century don't understand apocalyptic literature. So therefore, the folks who like to use this kind of language from Thessalonians, from Revelation, tend to scare us with these words, right? And at least the message that comes across to me is very threatening. You read things like the Left Behind series and listen to some of the apocalyptic preachers. Man, they're using these things, and if you're not one of this group, or you're not one of that group, or if you don't believe this, or you don't assent to this, then you're gone. Well, that's not very encouraging.
You're not gone.
But the message is, encourage one another with these words. Let God take us to a place that we can't even imagine, and it'll be glorious and magnificent and wonderful. Not threatening and not... not discouraging and not frightening. That's the purpose and that's the objective of apocalyptic literature. To provide hope and encouragement and inspiration to go beyond the troubles of the day. You know the spiritual in that great getting up morning? Yeah. Fare thee well, fare thee well, right? There's a better day a-coming. Fare thee well, yeah? When I did this course in my congregation, there's a wonderful recording that was Celebration of Spirituals or something like that. It's Kathleen Battle and Jesse Norman in this huge gospel choir and something like the New York Philharmonic or something, James Levine conducting. Just this enormous mass of singers and musicians. And if you've ever heard Jesse Norman sing, boom, it takes you to a new plane. It takes you someplace you can't imagine. And the two of them together with this great mass of musicians, there's a better day coming, and you know it, because they're telling you. That's what this is about. Encourage one another with these words. Same with Revelation. Wow, where are we? Okay. We're all the way up to the fifth word. Important here, though, it all focuses on Jesus Christ as the subject, as the object. I mean, it'd be about the fourth word in the text is Jesus Christ. That's an important thing to know. Which God gave him. Who is the him there? Important to know that God is the source of the revelation. Okay? This is not something John made up. This is not something that was produced from the culture, but the revelation comes from God who gave him. Got to be referring to Jesus, to show his servants, and that this his can be, you know, it always goes back, either God or Jesus, if that makes a difference, whose servants are we, whose servants are the audience. And the word servants is interesting as well. There's a footnote in the NRSV. The other word for this is slaves, right? Probably says so in the RSV too, if anybody has that. The Greek is doulos, which can mean slave or servant. Primary is probably slave. A slave belongs to somebody. Right? Slave is not independent, not free to go wherever he or she wants, but the slaves belong to the master who is his servants. This is addressed to the people of God in Jesus Christ. It's addressed to the Christian community. And so this is not one of those universal sorts of things that's addressed to the whole world. It's addressed to a particular audience, the servants of God in Christ. What must soon take place? Imperative here, right? Hadn't happened yet, which is kind of interesting when we get down to here, because this is the past tense. What must soon take place? There's a sense of imminence, a sense of short time, a sense of urgency about this that compels us as readers to, this is going to take place soon, all right, what's going to happen? And it will take place, but by whose action, who's driving this? You know, all those questions come right to the surface when we see these words put together, what must soon take place? And all of Revelation keeps moving us ahead, moving us toward the end. Starts from the very first sentence. He made it known, right? It's still referring back to the one who is providing the information here.
I don't know if you can add anything to that, but soon obviously has a lot of importance in terms of how people look at Revelations, because there are people for the last 2,000 years who have been saying soon is tomorrow.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you can add anything in terms of your study of what you think the author was meaning by soon. Did he mean a literal soon, do you think? Or
What does literal mean, yeah.
Well, literal maybe is not the right word, but in our time span.
Okay.
Because a lot of people think of Revelations, that's a lot of the issue. Like, well, soon, right.
Yeah.
And people today are saying it's tomorrow, you know.
Sure.
They've been saying that for a long time.
Yeah, how many tomorrows can people pass?
No, but that's the point, I thought,
yeah.
Is it? I mean,
yeah.
Let me respond to the question. What does that do for you?
Well, I don't think I have enough knowledge of it to do a lot, except that I think it has a lot to do with a lot of people's sense that this is a book that, well, for some people, we're going to ignore that because people have been using this for a long time,
mm-hmm.
to sort of pound this down our throat here and,
right.
and keep doing it over and over and over.
Right.
Because there are obviously a lot of people who want to use that as a way of, we know what the answer is,
mm-hmm.
and it's tomorrow.
Okay, but they're all wrong.
No, that's what I mean. So what is it?
Let's assume that they're all wrong, and what is the text trying to do?
Tell you to be prepared.
Yeah, be prepared, be ready. It provides an urgency about this, and you better pay attention to this, right?
When you dated this, you said the second half of the first century or
mm-hmm.
something. Is this? Are you putting it before or after the fall of Jerusalem?
Probably after.
Is that significant?
Because things have fallen apart. You know?
Yeah, and so it could be kind of a scary time.
They lost
their
center. Very scary time.
Right. So, John was supposedly exiled.
Right.
Can't go home.
Can't go home. So, if you can't look back, where do you look? You look pretty soon. And things are changing daily under these scary and unstable times. I think what this phrase, and particularly that word, is adding a sense of things are happening by the moment here. So we need to pay attention to this and hang on to this message. Stuff's happening all around us, We're being swept along, but we got something to hang on to with God and Jesus Christ. Does that kind of get at it?
Well, I think that is what someone else is saying about the sort of being prepared makes some sense, but a lot of people have used it as very chronological.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
2004 and March, whatever.
Right, and that's happened for a long time.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. One of the neat things that's in that Apocalypse book is a summary of the different ways Revelation's been interpreted. There are folks who see it as a chronological timetable, and they can identify all the all the events taking place. It's real popular these days, particularly with the Left Behind series being published, and people looking for signs, you know, and clipping out newspaper headlines and piecing them all together because they got the answer. Well, I'm really intrigued by that because, you know, that the same thing was happening in the 1800s when Millerites, who became the Seventh-day Adventists, when when Millers, they came and passed for the end of the world, they're sitting on the top of the mountain saying, all right, now what do we do? So the Seventh-day Adventist church kind of develops out of one of those kind of movements. The Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, also have a timetable, and they have some of the numbers down, I don't know, 44,000, those kind of things. Hal Lindsey was real popular in the, what was that, 50s, 60s? During the Cold War, he had it all figured out. The late great planet Earth, you know, the Soviet Union was the bad guy, and he had, I read that book, and he has a battle plan, you know, coming from the north, Gog and Magog and all those things, he had those all identified. Then the Soviet Union fell apart. Well, time to write another book. And he did, and he's still writing them, and making a bunch of money at it.
Because people want answers, they're not really willing to sit with the mystery.
Of course. Yeah.
But the Bible tells you that you don't know when.
How about that? Yeah. That's what the Left Behind series is about too. Mm-hmm. People want to know what's going to happen, and they want somebody to explain it to them in words they can understand. We don't like this apocalyptic stuff, you know, because we can't put our arms around it, we can't control it, we can't manage it. And we can't figure out in our scientific sort of methodical ways what it's telling us. And people who are willing to do that sell lots of books. But they're wrong. Sorry, they're wrong. That's not a way to use this kind of literature, and it's not a way to try to limit what's being communicated with this wonderful, rich, powerful message. But that's my bias. You can take that as well.
I think your statement, it takes you out of time, is very important.
Yeah.
Because people keep wanting to put it into time. And they want to make the timetable, and they want to specify everything. So the soon is not tomorrow necessarily.
Right.
It's all the time.
Right. Right, right. You know the two words in Greek for time. Oh man, give me 5 minutes. And the word time comes up in the text, and it's not here. But you know the Kairos and Chronos sense of time in Greek. Chronos is where we get our word chronology or chronometer. It's the passing of time, minutes, days, hours, that kind of thing, the kind of time we can mark. The idea of Kairos is the right time, the moment when everything comes together and something happens. God's time, it's sometimes called. You know, we can't quite figure it out, but it happens in God's good time. But that's what we're talking about, the kairos, the kairotic moment, if you will, when God determines that the moment is right. And I think the kairos is implied here. You know, when we get this sense of now is the moment. Well, you know, now is God's time. It's got less to do with chronology. Let's see if we can finish the first sentence. But that's how we finish here. So you're going to have to read the rest of the first chapter yourself. He made it known. The Greek means gave it significance. Right? Not just telling the story, but the story has some meaning. By sending, the verb is apostello, which we get our word apostle. Right? Somebody that's sent with a message, sent with a purpose, with authority, being a representative of a higher authority. And this messenger is an angelos, an angel. angel is a, I hope we get time to do all this, but that's a powerful word in Revelation. By sending with a purpose his angel to his servant, his doulos, John, one thing we're going to have to skip is, who is this John? Is this one of the Johns we know from the Gospels or from the letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John? Is this a different John who ended up on the island of Patmos? He makes no claim to be an apostle. He makes no claim to be one of the 12. No particular claim to be even an eyewitness to Jesus, but certainly part of the Christian community that people would recognize, so his name carries some authority. And I think that's why he includes it. But that's a real controversy, and trying to figure out who this John is an interesting study. Who testified, the word for testified is martyrapo, where we get our word, of course, martyr. In English it means somebody who died, but in Greek it's a witness. Who sent his martyr, his witness, to testify to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. So yeah, that's the clue that this, he's already seen it. So he's giving us a nice intro and giving us lots of clues about what's ahead.
Who do you think John is?
Who do I think John is? I've done enough work with this that I don't think it's the writer of the fourth gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Because the writer of the fourth gospel is a wonderful, well-crafted Greek writer. This is not. So I don't think it's the same person. The letters of John are closer to the gospel of John in their style, in some of the vocabulary they use. This is not. And the fact that John makes no claim to be an apostle, makes no claim to be one of the inner circle of Jesus' followers, seems to me, if he were really wanting to lay out his authority, he would say so. So I think it's a different John than we know from previous letters, but still somebody who is recognized and a leader in the community, who got in trouble and was sent into exile. Certainly somebody with a spiritual connection to what's going on and a reason to communicate with the rest of the Christian community. Well, my guess is it's a different writer than we know before. We have to quit. I'd like you to read chapter 1 if you get time. And particularly pay attention to the image of Jesus that's presented there. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but if we get too much into detail, we won't make it past the end of chapter 2 in 5 sessions. So I want to be careful about that. To make that connection, if you can, read the rest of chapter 1 between now and then. But this is for the village. You're free to do whatever you want. I have an outline of Revelation of the book here, if that's helpful for you. Maybe I'll copy it.